ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 5th of January. I'm Stephanie Smale, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, floodwaters continue to cause havoc in Queensland's north and central west, with major stock losses expected. And Jurassic Park Jeeps. Mega fans recreate the cars from the blockbuster film.
It's all about making people smile at the end of the day and creating those memories for people when they see the vehicle and have a photo or they see it drive past. For that few moments, you really are tapping into the fandom of whatever that car is and whatever it belongs to.
Criticism is mounting over the United States' capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Spain, China and Russia have all condemned the move, calling it a violation of international law. As the deposed President Maduro awaits his court appearance in New York, there are mixed feelings among Venezuelans about the end of his rule as leader. Nicole Johnston reports.
From president to prisoner, Venezuela's leader Nicolas Maduro is locked up, awaiting trial in New York. Late Saturday, he was escorted down the stairs of an aircraft at a National Guard base near New York, flanked by US security. Photos showed the deposed president handcuffed, wearing tracksuit pants, a hooded sweatshirt, and slide sandals with socks. Venezuela's vice president and oil and finance minister, Delcy Rodriguez, has been tapped to replace him, and she still supports him.
We demand the immediate release of President Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores. The only president of Venezuela is President Nicolas Maduro. He is the most important high command of the Venezuelan state and the military high command.
But President Donald Trump is in no mood for compromise. Kristi Noem is the US Secretary of Homeland Security.
I think President Trump is done negotiating. He proved that a couple of days ago, that he is a man of action, that when someone is threatening the United States, he will defend it with every resource that we have.
We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition.
U.S. President Donald Trump.
This extremely successful operation should serve as warning to anyone who would threaten American sovereignty or endanger American lives.
And this was the operation, a brazen weekend attack. Elite US forces were deployed to invade Venezuela and capture the president and his wife from their home in the middle of the night. The assault stunned Venezuelans around the world. Brisbane-based democracy activist Frank Madrid says most of his community is pleased the president has been deposed.
If you could imagine that the situation has been so dire that 8 million Venezuelans or even more had to leave Venezuela, it is the largest migration in contemporary history that is not due to an act of war or a national disaster. So, of course, Venezuelans are happy because they see that there is a glimmer of hope.
But in Caracas, there have been protests in support of Mr. Maduro, chanting for him to be returned and reinstated as president.
Today we find ourselves here in absolute support of our constitutional president, Nicolas Maduro. We are here telling the United States government that we are a peaceful people, but we are not fools. We're not afraid, and we're willing to give our lives, if necessary, to defend our territory.
So, who is in charge of Venezuela? Vanessa Neumann is a former Venezuelan special envoy to the UK. So far, the acting president, Rodriguez, has indicated her support for the president. Is it likely that at some stage she will abandon him?
I don't think that she will abandon the Madurista cause. She's between a rock and a hard place. The Trump team will expect her to more or less genuflect to the United States. But if she does that, she will be stabbed in the back, effectively, by Diosdado Cabello and or Padrino López, who do command whatever's left of the troops. So she has to kind of toe the hard line to keep the people behind her while also keeping the Americans on side.
Venezuelans are still in shock at these extraordinary events and deeply worried. Sandra Gatman is a UK-based Venezuelan journalist.
At the moment, you know, I just spoke to my grandmother, my 94-year-old grandmother, who's in the center of Caracas, and she says she can basically hear a pin drop outside. There are no cars, no one walking in the streets. So it's very eerie, and people are also scared about what might come next.
UK-based Venezuelan journalist Sandra Gatman, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. As the fallout continues, attention is turning to what will happen next in Venezuela, but also questions about whether there will be any repercussions for the United States. Dr. Dina Javala is an associate professor at the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law and Justice. I spoke to her a short time ago. Dr. Javala, thank you for joining us. Does the US capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro breach international law, and what are the implications if it has?
It has absolutely breached international law. I think that's unequivocally true. And I would say the implication both for international law but also for politics could not be more serious, right? These rules have been, at least in theory, the cornerstone of international order. Even when states have been violating them in the past, and they have done so in the past, they at least paid lip service to them. And we see currently the US administration not only violating these rules, but not even trying to say that they are not. So I would say this open disregard for international law is pretty new, and I would say it should be very concerning for states like Australia.
What is the importance of upholding international law going forward?
One should not be naive, I would say, about international law. International law very often in the past has been complicit with acts of war or aggression. But nevertheless, I would say the direction that the current US administration is taking the world is even worse than that, right? It's an open policy of force and an apologetic policy of violence and imposition that is, I would say, it's first extremely destabilizing for the international order. If great powers get the signal that, you know, everything goes, both the US but other powers will become increasingly brazen and aggressive. And I would say it is particularly concerning for middle powers like Australia, and of course also for smaller states and states in the global south, of course. So I would say this has the double effect of being both chaotic and potentially extremely unjust.
Have other countries, including Australia, reacted strongly enough to this move by President Trump? What should their message be?
So I would say there has been a big divide between different states. We have seen, unsurprisingly, Central and Latin American states reacting very rapidly and unequivocally condemning this act of aggression. But I would say Western states, including, unfortunately, Australia, have been much more equivocal in nature, right? Australia did put out an announcement, but its language was not nearly as strong as it should have been. It doesn't name the acts that they were committed, and it doesn't name them as acts of aggression and as grave violations of international law.
Is there a risk a lukewarm reaction could increase the chance of this sort of intervention elsewhere?
Absolutely. And I think that's what we're seeing now, right? This is the sort of a high school bully. If no one stands up to them, they're likely to continue their course. And we have already seen, for example, Marco Rubio threatening Cuba that perhaps, you know, a similar fate awakens them. We also have seen threats by this administration against Greenland escalating. So we know that within the administration in the US, they are people who support even further use of force and even more brazen expansionism. And I would say this lukewarm reaction by Australia and by others is actually empowering them, right? It's telling them that they're not losing allies over this. And I would say that's an extremely destabilizing environment.
Dr. Dina Javala from the University of New South Wales. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Queensland cattle producers are bracing for major stock losses as flooding continues to ravage parts of the state. There's been little reprieve for communities in Queensland's north and central west, but today there is hope for a small break for some as heavy rain subsides. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
It was a long, anxious night for residents of Winton in Queensland's remote central west as water levels continued to rise.
Around 10 o'clock yesterday evening, our western river peaked at 4.05 metres.
That's Winton Mayor Cathy White.
It was a bit full on there. We didn't know we had so much water that we were told coming down that river system. So, yeah, look, it was pretty anxious time. We had a few hours there in the afternoon. We thought that we had things up enough, but we lifted them up further again.
Councillor Cathy White says it's been an exhausting few days for residents, sandbagging, relocating animals and shifting logs out of rivers. Today, they woke up to blue sky sunshine and will begin the clean-up.
I just think people are relieved that the waters have gone down. I've talked to a couple of them already this morning and, you know, they're with the gurneys already getting that mud out.
But it's not such good news for many farmers. Northwest of Winton in Julia Creek, Luke Spreadborough's property is almost entirely underwater.
My property is 90,000 acres. Of that, you know, there's 65,000, 70,000 acres submerged.
Luke Spreadborough, who is also a councillor for McKinlay Shire Council, says it's a similar picture for his neighbours.
Surrounding properties are anywhere between 200,000 acres and 60,000 acres, some of which are totally submerged. They're literally down to a few islands. I'm just trying to save what little livestock they've got left and, yeah, just trying to do as much as they can for their animals.
Although heavy rainfall has eased for Winton, Julia Creek and many other parts of the state, impacted areas remain on high flood alert. Phelim Hanafy is a senior forecaster for the Bureau of Meteorology.
We expect those rivers, particularly across interior parts and northwestern areas, like to remain elevated for some time. There's still quite a large volume of water across land that has yet to flow into the river systems. So these rivers still likely to see some further rises possible in the coming days as large volumes upstream move down.
Phelim Hanafy says looking forward, the Bureau is watching a potential tropical cyclone in far north Queensland.
Now, the watch point is that later this week, we expect the potential for a renewed burst of increased monsoon activity, particularly up over parts of far north Queensland, initially up over the peninsula as well. And this will culminate in a potential tropical low to develop off the far northeast tropical coast as we go into later this week.
He says while communities have a few days of reprieve, that weather system could bring more heavy rain later this week.
Julia Bergen reporting. All 40 people who died in a New Year's Eve bar fire in Switzerland have now been identified, with teenagers, some as young as 14, making up more than half the death toll. Hundreds of people have marched through the Swiss ski resort town of Crans-Montana to honour the victims. Swiss authorities have launched an investigation into two bar managers on suspicion of negligence, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Alleluia, alleluia.
Hundreds of mourners stand arm in arm, heads bowed, some weeping quietly. On Sunday, residents of the small ski resort town of Crans-Montana marched through the streets, paying their respects to those who died in a fire at La Constellation Bar on New Year's Eve. Police say the identities of all 40 people who died have now been confirmed. A further 119 people were injured, including many with severe burns. Fernando Rebullion lives nearby and attended the Sunday memorial.
I just learned 2 minutes ago that one of my son's friends died. Another one is going to the hospital with burns. That's all.
The crowd applauds as firefighters and rescue teams arrive. Letitia Broddard, the mother of 16-year-old Arthur, who died in the blaze, cries as she embraces first responders and friends. I could have saved him, she says. Perhaps I could have saved him. It's so unfair. More than half of those who died were teenagers, some as young as 14. Local DJ Nicola says the whole community is in mourning.
We've been one big family for a long time. It's awful, especially for young people like that, and the circumstances of the tragedy, it's terrible. Especially on New Year's Day, it's really a family celebration. Everyone loves each other. Nothing bad ever happens here.
Investigators say they believe sparklers attached to champagne bottles ignited the fire when they came too close to the ceiling of the crowded bar. On Saturday, prosecutors announced the two people who ran the bar have been placed under criminal investigation on suspicion of offences including homicide by negligence, causing bodily harm by negligence, and arson by negligence. Local resident Patricia Mazzoni says the community wants answers.
One needs a moment to gather oneself, to pray, to come up for air, so to speak. But afterwards, I would like an independent investigation. An independent investigation to know who failed. Because when you look at the videos, you see that it catches fire immediately. That's not normal.
Beat Jans is the Swiss Federal Councillor for Justice.
We know that we have to clarify all the responsibilities. The cantonal authorities are in charge of the investigation. And once we have all the facts, we can answer these questions. We know that this is, the world needs to know the responsibilities. And as soon as we have the information, we can give it.
Switzerland will hold a national day of mourning for the victims on Friday.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. It's a global misconception that dementia is a normal part of ageing, but it's actually a brain condition caused by a range of different disorders. In Australia, it's estimated more than 430,000 people are living with dementia, and while there's no known cure, there are treatments for many of the symptoms. As for what to look out for, it isn't simply memory loss, as Tanya Dendrinos reports.
It was an ordinary trip that became a defining sign for Richard Davies.
I was driving back from a football game that I did regularly. It was a route that I'd done many times. And I came to one particular part of the route and I thought, this doesn't look familiar anymore.
The 60-year-old says that moment stayed with him and forced him to pay attention to changes in his cognition. Richard's wife, Jules, says she noticed signs of his cognitive decline 2 years ago.
The thing in our family, which all of us will always mention, complete inability to switch off the gas hob. That's probably one of the very, very first things that we all noticed, isn't it? Because both of my kids will go, Dad, have you switched off the oven? Have you switched it off this time? Is it off?
Even so, she says the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease that came in September was unexpected.
To be honest, the day that we were told, I was shocked. I didn't expect it.
Yes, I remember that vividly.
But very soon after that, I actually found that whilst it's not a diagnosis that I obviously wanted him to have, it made everything fall into place. So it did make sense of a lot of things.
Henry Bradati is a professor of ageing and mental health and co-director of the Centre for Healthy Brain Ageing at the University of New South Wales.
People say, well, if I do forget where I parked my car or somebody's name, does that mean I'm getting dementia? Probably not. We all have these symptoms, and what I'm saying, that can be part of normal ageing. But where they progress and they're starting to interfere with day-to-day function, where people are noticing or perhaps talking about you because of it, then that's more of a worry.
Dementia is an umbrella term for a collection of symptoms caused by disorders affecting the brain.
Of the 100 causes, the most likely cause is Alzheimer's disease, accounting for over 50%. Vascular dementia, problems with circulation in the brain, could be the small vessels getting clogged up gradually, or it could be small strokes or even a larger stroke or a hemorrhage.
The symptoms vary for each, and while memory loss is perhaps the most recognisable, it's not the only sign.
It may be people become more irritable, or their personality becomes like a caricature of themselves. Or the opposite, there may be a flattening of personality, so it's more apathetic, not interested in anything. This is particularly in frontotemporal dementia, where memories actually doesn't get affected till later in the disease for most people.
Professor Bradati says another possible symptom of frontotemporal dementia relates to language, losing the ability to string words together or to understand the meaning of words.
In the Lewy body dementia, often the first symptom is quite unusual. It's REM sleep disorder. It can be restless legs or people moving around and hitting their partner during the night in their sleep. And then people also get some other unusual symptoms. They get visual hallucinations. They also have a greater tendency to have falls.
Risk factors for dementia include things like high blood pressure, diabetes, and a lack of physical activity. And there are social determinants too.
We know that people who have fewer social connections, who are more isolated, who are more lonely, have a higher rate of dementia.
Richard Davies is now working as a dementia advocate and urges others to be proactive with their health.
Get diagnosed as early as you can. This is not a minor disease. You can't shake it off. You can't ignore it. So you better get to know it. And you're not alone. And there is plenty of active support. And in many ways, it will actually improve your life.
Dementia advocate Richard Davies ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. A group of Aussies passionate about the movie Jurassic Park have gone the extra mile in their fandom of the 90s blockbuster. They have recreated the cars from the groundbreaking film, and some of them have even made it to the big screen. Angus Randall reports.
It's an iconic moment in one of the biggest movies of the 1990s. The camera zooms in on actor Sam Neill. He rises from his seat in an open Jeep, the music swells, and the first truly realistic-looking dinosaur in film history walks onto screen.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Zachary Weir gets to relive that moment every day. Well, at least the part with the Jeep. He's built a replica of the open-top car from Jurassic Park. It was an adventure 32 years in the making.
My parents actually went and saw it in the cinema when my mum was still pregnant with me, so I think that's probably where it started.
He works as a sign writer, but has held a bunch of jobs that gave him the skills to turn a regular used Jeep into a movie replica.
Welding, metal bending and electrical work for the lighting, all that kind of stuff, have just picked up over the years.
Zachary Weir no longer uses his Jeep for the daily commute, but whenever he takes to Adelaide's streets, he can expect the same reaction.
Every time I park somewhere, basically, I get people coming up asking for photos, that kind of thing. One guy nearly actually crashed his bike getting a gander as he was going past.
There's a whole community out there recreating cars from Jurassic Park, whether it's the Jeep or the tour vehicles attacked by the escaped T-Rex.
Keep absolutely still. This vision is based on movement.
Byron Phillips is from the Jurassic Park Motor Pool, which takes part in events and charity work across the country.
For that few moments, you really are tapping into the fandom of whatever that car is and whatever it belongs to.
Unlike Zachary Weir, he was lacking any mechanical skills when he first started putting his car together around a decade ago. So he was grateful he could refer back to the Motor Pool for advice.
There's an online resource and a group where they can compare notes and give guidance on certain parts of the Jeeps. It's always there and people learn from each other. They learn from their mistakes. There's been many mistakes made.
Several cars from the Jurassic Park Motor Pool made it to the big screen in 2024 when amateur filmmakers in regional Victoria released a shot-for-shot low-budget remake of the original film.
I own an island.
John Roebuck directed Jurassic Park Castlemaine Redux. He says the added production value was immense.
I think the cast and crew were used to sort of me turning up to set with spray-painted super soakers or very flimsily made Velociraptor pens that I'd spent weeks building that fell apart as soon as we finished shooting. So I think the day the cars turned up, there really was an air of excitement. It felt like a level up.
Whether it's a Jurassic Park Jeep, a Back to the Future DeLorean, or a Batmobile, Zachary Wire has a simple message to anyone wanting to recreate their favourite movie vehicle.
I guess just do it. Like, it's actually not as hard as you think once you get started. Like, it's always just taking that first small step, like getting a set of wheels, painting them. From there, you'll realise, oh, okay, it's actually not that bad. It's bit by bit.
Jurassic Park car owner Zachary Wire, Angus Randall reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Stephanie Smale.